Knowing what you'd like to change, let's say it's several things, carve those aspects of the relationship out of the circle so that you end up with something that looks like a blob whose area is the size of the relationship that seems best to you. As you face what the relationship needs to be, there could be a sense of loss, dashed hopes, frustration, or disenchantment. Be mindful of this and compassionate toward yourself. There may be things you can't alter, such as your role in the care of an aging parent or inevitable encounters with someone at work. But even if you can't change something outside of yourself, at least inside your own mind you can pull back, and you can limit the impacts of others upon you. Usually you can make some changes in a relationship. You could tell the other person what you're doing and why, or simply start acting in new ways. After this, one of three things could happen. First, your changes might prompt a serious effort at repair by the other person. If that goes well, consider expanding the relationship back to what it used to be. Second, the person or other parties, such as relatives, could try to pull you back into how things were in the past. Remember that you have the right to change the relationship, and remember why you did so. Third, the person could accept your new approach or simply have no say in it. For example, no one can force you to return calls or emails if you'd rather not. Unless you have a compelling duty to a person, such as a child or a patient, you have the right to change the relationship if you want to. There's a certain toughness in this, but there may also be kindness. If deep down you don't feel comfortable or happy with how things have been going, other people usually sense that, even if they don't put it into words. When you act to make a relationship better for you, sometimes it gets better for others as well. Key points. The times we need courage the most are often while talking with other people. Open, authentic communication is fundamental to any significant relationship, but it's also risky. To make it safe for yourself, recognize any real dangers, talk about talking, and separate solving problems from sharing experiences. Speaking wisely means saying things that are well-intended, true, beneficial, timely, not harsh, and if possible, wanted. To assert yourself skillfully, establish the facts and know your values. Focus on the results you want, consolidate your gains, and emphasize what will happen from now on. Make requests, not demands, and establish clear agreements. Relationships are inherently unstable and naturally need repairs. It's a red flag if someone in a significant relationship is unwilling to repair it. When you make repairs, double-check what you think happened. Then get on your own side and don't be embarrassed about telling others that you've been let down, hurt, or mistreated. If necessary, shrink the relationship to a size and shape that is safe for you. Chapter 11, Aspiration. Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? Mary Oliver. To live is to lean into the future. We're always stretching toward one thing or another. The next person, the next task, the next sight or sound, the next breath. This chapter focuses on meeting your need for satisfaction by reaching for and achieving results that are important to you, such as deepening an intimate relationship, getting a better job, or growing into a new way of being at home or work. In particular, we'll explore how to pursue your aims while being fundamentally at peace with whatever happens. Honoring your dreams. A person's path through life, day by day, year after year, is shaped by many factors. Some are not possible to control, such as your genetics or birthplace. But studies in adult development show that you still have much influence over how things turn out through how you work through cycles of stability and change, draw on teachers and mentors, and realize your dreams, including the ones you had in childhood. What you knew when you were young. Children, including very little ones, know many things, even if they can't put them into words. For example, my earliest memories are colored with a watchful, wistful awareness that there was much unnecessary unhappiness in my family, other kids, and grown-ups in general. Nothing horrible, just a lot of needless tension, worry, and bickering. Looking back, I can see a persistent longing to understand why this was happening and to do something about it. Over time, that longing became a guiding purpose. There have been times when I pushed it to the back of my mind or forgot it entirely. In retrospect, that was when it most felt like I'd lost my way. How about you? Think about your earliest memories and the youngest layers of your psyche. What did you see around you, and what did you wish for? What did you know as a young child that you couldn't put into words back then? As you grew older, through your teens and into young adulthood, what were your ambitions, wild ideas, and secret hopes? Think about the kind of people you imagined being with and the kind of person you imagined becoming. Then consider what has happened to those dreams. We all have dreams we've ignored or deferred. They rest inside us like a coin at the bottom of a well. Sometimes there are good reasons for setting a dream aside, but often people needlessly dismiss an important dream as childish or foolish, or just keep pushing it down the road. It's so easy, poignantly, sadly easy, to talk yourself out of pursuing things that could be very fulfilling while also contributing to other people. With this in mind, let's explore the factors that can get in the way of your dreams. The impact of others. We are naturally influenced by the opinions of other people. Consider how your parents, friends, and teachers affected your dreams. Think about who has encouraged and helped you, and who has been dismissive, doubting, or undermining. How do the effects of all this linger on in your life today? For example, do you feel comfortable revealing your dreams to others? Think about your attitudes toward your dreams. Then ask yourself, which of these attitudes are truly mine, and which have I borrowed from other people? Deep down, what do I want? What matters most to me? The dreaded experience. People often swerve away from their dreams to avoid risking experiences they dread. For example, someone might not pursue a romantic relationship in order to prevent the possibility of rejection. The edges of the experiences we fear form a kind of invisible fence that limits the life we allow ourselves to have. Take some time to think about how your life has been bounded and shaped by the experiences you've tried to avoid. Consider the things that happened to you, that you saw happening to others, or that you thought might happen. Also think about your temperament. For instance, some people are particularly affected by threats to connection, so it is a high priority to them to avoid experiences related to shame, such as feeling that they've done something wrong or are a bad person. Other people are most affected by threats to safety, so they go out of their way to avoid experiences related to anxiety, such as business travel on airplanes. Think about a turning point in your life in which you veered away from pursuing a dream. At that time, what experiences were you trying to avoid? These days, do you say less than you could and play smaller than you need to in order to avoid risking certain experiences? Consider how your life would expand if you were willing to take those risks. Dreaded experiences cast a long shadow over our dreams. But what we dread is usually rooted in childhood, and today it is much less likely, less painful, and less overwhelming than we fear. Pick something that is important to you, but which you've been putting off pursuing. Next, ask yourself this: what have I been avoiding? It's fine to think about situations or interactions, and then try to dig deeper and find the uncomfortable, stressful experiences you fear you might have in those situations or interactions. Once you have identified the experiences you haven't wanted to risk, really consider these questions. 1. What are the chances, actually, that events would turn out as you fear if you pursue this dream? 2. Even if events did go badly, how painful an experience would you likely have? How soon would it begin to fade? 3. How could you cope with the experience? What inner resources could you draw on to deal with it? 4. What benefits would come to you and others from fulfilling this dream? What benefits would come from simply pursuing it? Take some moments to get a feeling for these benefits. Then ask yourself truly, are these benefits worth taking the risk of a dreaded experience? The essence of your dream. At this point, you might be thinking something like, well, I wanted to be a movie star as a child, and are you saying I need to be a movie star or I'll never be happy? Not at all. The dream itself is not to be a movie star. Being a movie star is a means to various ends, such as fame, the enjoyment of acting, and financial success. It is not an end in itself. People frequently get caught up in certain means to the true ends of their dreams, but this distracts them from the end itself and often keeps it out of reach. Pick an important dream and ask yourself, what are the foundational, emotional, or interpersonal elements that are the essence of this dream? Could there be other ways to fulfill this essence, to achieve the end the dream aspires to, besides the ways you've pursued so far? What would this be like? Whatever your fears and limitations may have been in the past, get a sense of giving yourself over to the dream today. Imagine the dream, in a sense, dreaming you, living through you and as you. Stay with the experience of this, letting it sink down into you and become stable inside you. Deep down, see if you can feel the essence of this dream and see if you can say yes to it. Love and work and play. To act upon your dreams in concrete ways, let's consider three key areas of life. First, love, including friendship, intimate relationships, raising children, compassion, and kindness. Second, work, including a job, career, making a home, or helping others. Third, play, which includes creativity, imagination, fun, hobbies, delight, wonder, and awe. Take a little time to assess each area, knowing that they can overlap somewhat. What's going well, and what do you wish were different? An effective way to improve each one of these areas of life is to increase the degree to which it is based upon your likes, which include activities, situations, and topics that give you pleasure, and your talents, your innate, natural abilities of all kinds, such as writing, fixing machinery, being funny, leading meetings, staying calm under pressure, cooking, or making music. And third, your values, the things that are important to you, such as children or the environment. Imagine that your likes, talents, and values are each a circle. The intersection of any two circles is good, and the intersection of all three circles is best of all. For example, if your work combines what you really like doing in its own right, what you are naturally good at, and what you most care about, then you're likely to be fulfilled and successful with it. Other factors could be relevant, such as the job market, but if you got the fundamentals right, the rest usually follows. For each area of your life, think about how you could realistically increase what you like, shine at, and value. In the area of love, for instance, if a long-term relationship has become less pleasurable and enjoyable, you could talk about this with your partner and explore what to do about it. Or, in the area of work, there might be new ways to use your skills in service to others, such as joining the board of a nonprofit. Honoring what you like, are gifted at, and feel committed to can mean taking your own path and turning away from more conventional ones. For example, there's a common notion that kids ought to know what they want to be when they grow up. A doctor, maybe, or an artist, or astronaut. But many adults don't have a specific occupation that calls to them. In fact, this could be quite natural, since our hunter-gatherer ancestors were generalists, not specialists with narrow job descriptions. When you eventually come toward the end of your life and look back over it, staying true to yourself and taking chances to honor your dreams could turn out to have been the safest bet of all. Use the time that you have. There's a saying that the days are long, but the years are short. An hour, especially if you're bored, can seem endless. Yet, as the seconds tick by, they are gone forever. And we don't know what the future holds, including perhaps an accident or illness around the corner. As Stephen Levine has pointed out, each of us will come to a day when there is just 1 year to live and not know when that line has been crossed. Life is fragile, fleeting, and precious. It's not morbid to recognize this. Rather, it's a way to celebrate the days we do have and commit to making the best of them. Many years ago, I was moaning and groaning to my friend Tom about how long it was going to take to finish grad school and fulfill all the postdoctoral requirements to become a psychologist. I was in my mid-30s and tired of still being a student. I complained that I might even be 40 years old, which seemed ancient at the time, before I was licensed. Tom asked, "Do you plan on being 40?" Startled, I said, "Yeah, I hope so." "Well then," he went on, "how do you want it to be?" I've thought about Tom's questions many times since. Sometimes something is just not possible. For example, it may be too late to change a career or have a child. But more often than not, people presume too easily and too quickly that an opportunity has irrevocably passed. Consider a long-standing desire, such as starting a business, riding horses again, getting back into a romantic relationship, or seeing the Parthenon, and then pick an age 5 or 10 years from now. Ask yourself, do I plan on being that age? How do I want it to be? Imagine that you're approaching the end of your life and looking back at it. What will you be glad you've done with the days that remain to you? As you consider this, you might find that there's a fire in your belly for one more big push in your career or one more big project. Or perhaps something smaller is calling to you, such as volunteering at the hospital, meditating more regularly, making peace with a relative, going back to church, seeing the Grand Canyon, learning to play the piano, moving closer to grandchildren, or getting involved in local politics. Or maybe what really matters to you is not a specific thing, but rather a way of being, such as becoming more carefree, self-accepting, loving, and playful. Whatever it is that calls you, make it important to you. You could write it down, make a collage about it, or bring it to mind each day. Then plan the steps that will make it happen for real, and imagine the good things that will come to you and others. Use the HEAL process to repeatedly take in this association between actions and rewards so that you will take these steps. Feel a sense of commitment and help that sink in too. And then act to make your dream a reality. Try to value each day as literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Aspiring without attachment. Many years ago, I spent a week rock climbing in Colorado with my friend Bob and our guide, Dave. On the first day, I thrashed and failed on an intermediate climb, graded 5.8, which Bob scooted right up. Afterward, Dave asked us what our goals were for the week. I said, "I want to climb 5.11, which is seriously hard." Bob, a very determined, ambitious, competitive guy, the same Bob in the chapter on grit, who nearly froze to death, breaking a trail for us through soft snow, burst out, "You're crazy, you'll never do it, and then you'll feel bad about yourself." Bob was on my side and wanted to protect me from the disappointment and embarrassment he would feel in my place. But for me it was the opposite, because this was such an outlandish goal. It was win-win to pursue it. If things didn't work out, there'd be no shame, and if I succeeded, it would feel great. We climbed every day with Dave, and I started getting better. By midweek, my goal didn't seem quite so crazy, and Bob got excited that this might actually happen. On the very last day, I started up a solid 5.11 crack and made it to the top without a fall, and was completely thrilled. This has been such an example for me of what it's like to aspire without attachment, to dream big dreams and pursue them with commitment while also being at peace with whatever happens. But easier said than done, how do we go full throttle while staying in the green zone? Have a growth mindset. This term comes from Carol Dweck's research on people who focus more on their efforts to learn and grow than on the specific results they've achieved. For example, if a person is in a tennis game against a much better player, the goal could shift from winning points to improving the backhand. People with a growth mindset tend to be happier, more resilient, and more successful. Think of a big goal and what it would feel like to redefine success in terms of developing new skills, understanding others better, or acquiring knowledge. Then, no matter what occurs, you've still succeeded. This attitude makes it easier to aim high. It's quite often possible to accomplish something that's a lot more meaningful with just a little more effort. Big goals focus the mind, inspire us, and motivate sustained work. It's counterintuitive, but the bigger the goal, the more likely it could be that you will reach it. Know that it's all right to fail. Failure happens. Not everything works out. There's a story about a Zen master who had helped many people and accomplished many things. Toward the end of his life, he was asked how he felt about all that he'd done. He smiled ruefully and said, "One failure after another." No one succeeds in a big way without sometimes failing in a big way. If you fail, you'll be in good company. How would it feel if you aimed high but fell short? There could be disappointment, a sense of wasted effort, and fears about looking bad in the eyes of others. And would you still be basically all right? Would your life go on? Would your friends still like you? And would you have other opportunities? Because of its negativity bias, the brain fixates on the handful of tiles in reality's mosaic that will indeed flash red if you fail. Meanwhile, it downplays the many more tiles that will stay a steady green, such as the love of others, the comfort in your bed, and the dignity and self-respect in knowing you tried hard and kept faith with yourself. In your heart, see if you can accept whatever happens. You may not like it, but you can be all right with it. People sometimes worry that if they accept failure, they'll become complacent and give up. Actually, the more willing you are to fail, the more likely you are to succeed. The fear of failure is burdensome, like a brick in your backpack as you climb up the road of life, and preoccupations with failure bind attention and energy. If you accept the possibility of defeat, you improve the chance of victory. Don't take it too personally. Try to appreciate that many of the causes of success or failure don't have your name on them. For example, my own efforts helped me climb 5.11 in Colorado, but many other factors, such as Dave's skill as a guide, Bob's supportive friendship, and good weather on our last day, had nothing to do with me. The perhaps uncomfortable reality is that much of what shapes our lives is beyond our control, including environmental, genetic, historical, cultural, and economic factors. Major events are often dictated by random chance, such as a lucky meeting, where a resume landed in a pile, or a careless driver drifting into another lane. If a person gets caught up in comparisons with others, pulling for approval, or quarreling over crumbs of credit, then me, myself, and I have taken over. So try to hold a sense of self lightly. The preoccupation with self feels tense and undermines support from others. Plus, it makes us attach stressfully and possessively to particular results, like Gollum in The Lord of the Rings clinging to my precious. Let aspiration carry you along. One way to fulfill an aspiration is to push toward it as if it were outside you, in the distance, like scratching and clawing up a mountain. That might work for a while, but it's exhausting. The other way is to give yourself over to the aspiration and let it pull you along, like rafting downstream in a river. In effect, you are using your will to surrender to your aspiration, which is both more comfortable and more sustainable. To get a sense of this, pick an aspiration. Imagine it outside of you, separate from you, off in the distance as a goal that you are pushing and straining toward. Notice how this feels. Then imagine the aspiration as a purpose that is already joined with you and is lifting and energizing and carrying you along. Now, notice how this feels. For this particular aspiration, use the heel steps to internalize the second way of relating to it. Pick other aspirations and get a sense of being lifted and carried by them. Enrich and absorb these experiences so that the second approach to aspiration becomes habitual for you. Making your offering. Many of the ways that we love, work, and play are a kind of offering to others. Think about what you give, large and small, at home, on the job, to friends, to strangers, and to the wider world. We all offer so much each day, even if we don't realize it in the moment. When you look at the things you do as offerings, they feel simpler, lighter, and more heartfelt. Even routine, seemingly trivial tasks take on new meaning and value. There's less sense of pressure. Instead of worrying about how others might respond, the focus shifts to doing what you can yourself, as I learned many years ago when speaking with a friend, an aspiring Zen priest. He was about to give his first talk at the center in San Francisco where he was training, which was very important, even sacred to him. I had read in the news that homeless people would come in off the street to the meditation hall simply because they wanted to be in a warm and safe place, not because they were interested in Buddhism. In a teasing, provocative way, I asked him how he felt about people in the audience not actually caring about what he was saying. He looked at me like I'd missed the point. We were sitting facing each other, and he made a gesture as if he were placing something at my feet. "I just make the offering," he said. "I try to create a good talk, maybe tell a joke to keep it interesting. But after that, it's out of my hands. What they do with it is up to them." He didn't say this coldly or dismissively, like he didn't care about other people. He was just being calm and realistic. And by not trying to force others to appreciate what he was saying, he would actually have a better chance of reaching them. I think about the lesson of the fruit tree in my backyard. We can pick a sturdy sapling, plant it well, and water it over the years, but we can't force it to produce an apple. We can tend to the causes but can't control the results. All we can do is make the offering. Know what you're offering. It's easy to lose sight of exactly what you want to offer, especially in complex situations or relationships. You might feel pressured by what others want you to do, or you could take for granted a role you acquired in early adulthood. Consequently, it can help to clarify for yourself what is and is not your task, job, duty, or purpose with a particular person or setting. For example, when Jan and I became parents, we had to figure out who was going to do what. I'm the sort of person who makes to-do lists, and it helped me to develop a mental job description for myself as a father and husband. Then I knew what to do each day and didn't obsess over whether I'd dropped the ball. This may sound a little mechanical, but in practice it feels natural, informal, and flexible, and oh so clarifying and freeing. There is a peacefulness in knowing that you have done your part and everything else is not your responsibility. Let's say you have a relationship with a coworker, friend, or family member. What's for you to do, and what's for them to do? For example, with teenage children, you could decide that it is your job to insist that they do their homework, to help them as needed, and to impose consequences if they skip classes. But only they can actually learn anything from school. Or consider a romantic partner. You can give love, attention, and affection, but, poignant as it is, love for you is the other person's offering to give. People often get caught up in trying to make something happen inside the black box of another person's mind, such as getting someone to think, feel, or care in a certain way. So much frustration and conflict comes from this. As appropriate, you can give your opinions and recommendations and the reasons for them. That's your offering. The rest is the other person's decision. In particular, we cannot make others happy, even our own children. Nonetheless, it's common to experience a burdensome sense of responsibility for the mood or behavior of particular people, especially family members. We can take reasonable steps, ranging from asking how someone is feeling to taking a child to a therapist. But as heart-wrenching as it may be, what others do with what we offer is up to them. Or let's say you have a project at work. Think about all that you can do and should do, and then draw a line around it. That's your offering. The same with your career in general. Show up, prepare, learn, put in the hours, be consistent, do your job. Then you can know that whatever your trajectory of success may be in this life, a lack of effort did not lower it. The rest is up to so many other factors. You can give a great sales pitch, but you can't make a prospect say yes. You can open a shop, but you can't make people come into it. Try not to let a preoccupation with what's out of your hands get in the way of taking care of what's in your reach each day. Find fertile ground. Sometimes we make an offering, but it's like casting seeds on stony soil. Consider your activities and relationships and see if there are any of these indicators of less than fertile ground. Giving much more than you're getting in a friendship, or needing to make extreme efforts to keep a business afloat. Helping people who don't want to be helped. Trying to make something better keeps making it worse. Or picking the same sort of person while expecting different results. Fighting hard to gain crumbs. Communicating into what feels like a vacuum. Or tackling symptoms without changing disease or dysfunction. When you pour yourself into something that's not bearing much fruit, it can feel sad and disappointing. You may want to keep pushing and hope you'll finally turn a corner. This might work out, but the best predictor of the future is usually the past. See if you know in your heart that things are not likely to get better. There is such a thing as healthy disenchantment, which can feel like waking up from a kind of spell. Each of us has many gifts, but limited time. Effort spent trying to grow roses in cement is effort that would produce better results elsewhere for both you and others. Think about different relationships, settings, or activities that might provide more fertile ground. No guarantees, but better odds. Often there is an intuition that says, try this. Consider your temperament, natural gifts, and deep nature. Who could use what you've got? What settings and activities pull the best out of you? What kind of person always seems to appreciate you? Where do you feel most at home? Think about a time in your life when you really blossomed. Perhaps it was a week each summer at your aunt's farm, a play in high school, a talk given at a work conference, or a passionate letter to the editor. Perhaps it was when you took a group of children camping, did a financial analysis, worked in a stable, brought food to a homeless shelter, or built a website. When you identify such a time, look closely at its characteristics. What were the best things about it? Then consider how you might be able to develop some of these characteristics in your current relationships, settings, and activities. In other words, helping them to become more fertile ground for you. Also consider how you could step into a new relationship, setting, or activity that would be a good fit for you. Something that's nurturing and appreciative, with room to breathe and room to grow. If it is fine to wish such fertile ground for your child or for your friend, it is also fine to seek it for yourself in your one wild and precious life. Key points. When we are young, we have hopes and dreams for the life we'd like to have. What has happened to your own dreams along the way? People swerve away from their dreams for a variety of reasons. In particular, they try to avoid dreaded experiences. Consider how it could enlarge your life to risk these experiences. In love, work, and play, find the sweet spot at the intersection of three circles: what you enjoy, what you're talented at, and what you care about. The days may be long, but the years are short. Use the time that you have. To aim high while being at peace with the results, have a growth mindset. Know that it's all right to fail, and don't take what happens too personally. Offer what you can, and know that after that, it's out of your hands. Chapter 12, Generosity. Who gives? one's virtues shall increase. The Digha Nikaya. Like most young children, Forrest liked sweets. One time when he was in preschool, we went out to dinner at a local restaurant, and an older man and woman at the next table watched us with amusement. When the check arrived with a red-striped peppermint, I gave it to Forrest, and he started eagerly unwrapping it. As a joke, the man sitting next to us reached out his hand and asked, "Can I have your candy?" We all expected Forrest to hold on to it possessively. Instead, he looked at the man for a few seconds and handed him the peppermint. The man was startled, and then he gave Forrest a huge smile as he said, "Oh no, thank you, but you keep it." Other diners nearby had been watching, and there was an audible awe around us. It was just a little moment, just a little boy in a crowded restaurant, but we could all relate to the generosity in it. At first glance, generosity may not seem like a mental resource, but it strengthens you with a sense of the fullness that's already inside you, while also connecting you with other people. Generosity to them is a gift to you along the way, giving you even more to offer in a positive cycle. We've already explored many ways to fill up your own cup, which gives you more that you can place in the cups and hands and hearts of others. In this chapter, we'll begin with recognizing and expanding generosity in daily life. Next, we'll see how to bring equanimity to compassion so that you can keep giving without becoming depleted. Then we'll dive into one of the most important but hardest ways to give, which is to forgive others and yourself. We'll conclude with the widest expression of generosity, expanding the circle of us to include more and more of them. Everyday giving. The essence of generosity is altruism, giving without expecting anything in return. As I said in the chapter on confidence, altruism is rare in nature since freeloaders can exploit generosity. The great exception to this rule is our own species, Homo sapiens. The evolving social capabilities of our ancestors gave them increasingly powerful ways to recognize and punish freeloaders. Meanwhile, the generosity of one individual, sharing food, defending against aggression by outsiders, could increase the chances of survival of others with whom that person shared genes. Tendencies toward altruism were both protected and valuable, and they became woven into our DNA. In many ways, we are Homo beneficus, the generous human. As a result, generosity is everywhere around us. Obvious examples include leaving a tip in the jar at a coffee shop or sending a check to charity, but also consider all the non-financial kinds of giving. Think about a typical day and the many times you offer your attention, patience, help, or encouragement. Perhaps you commiserate with a coworker who's had a hard day, pick up a piece of trash on the sidewalk, or help organize a school event. With children, relatives, friends, or your partner, you surely do many things that are not your preference in the moment and stretch to take others into account. Whatever it is that you do give is not lessened by what you don't give, nor is it lessened by what you receive from others. As you go through your day, notice some of the many things you give. Slow down to feel what it's like to be generous and let the sense of this sink into you. Try to recognize yourself as a giving, generous person and notice what it feels like inside to see yourself in this way. There could be an opening in your heart, a sense of worth, and love. You can enjoy a happiness in giving that helps to sustain it. When we're unable to give what we have to offer, it aches inside. There is love, but no one to give it to. There is talent, but no place to use it. A quiet sadness in many people comes from feeling that the contributions they could make have no outlet. It's important to find channels through which your gifts can flow, especially the seemingly small ones in daily life. It's striking how simple it can be to add to the lives of other people, even just by offering a little praise or giving your full attention for longer than usual. You could pick someone and look for ways to be particularly appreciative or helpful. See how this feels for you, and see what happens for the other person. Think about a friend, family member, or coworker. Is there anything you'd like to give, such as loving warmth, practical help, or an apology, but for some reason you're holding back? Maybe there's a good reason. But sometimes we're so self-absorbed about what we have to give, ruminating over how people will react, fixing every little detail, or waiting for the absolutely perfect right time, that we get in our own way. See what happens when you pull attention out of yourself and place it on and in other people. What do they need? What do they long for? Where are they hurting? And how could you help? Compassion with equanimity. The word compassion comes from the Latin roots com and pati, which mean to suffer with. We add the suffering of others to our own, a gift at the heart of being human. How can we be moved by the sorrows of others without becoming flooded, drained, or burned out? To sustain compassion, we need equanimity, a kind of inner shock absorber between the core of your being and whatever is passing through awareness. Some experiences are first darts, such as feeling the suffering of others. With equanimity, these don't become second darts that push you into the reactive red zone. You can see the bigger picture, including the sweet amidst the bitter, and the many causes, most of them impersonal, that lead to suffering. For example, a teacher of mine once described taking a small boat down the Ganges River at dawn and seeing beautiful rose-lit towers on the left and smoking funeral pyres on the right. She talked about the need to develop a heart that's wide enough to include both of these aspects of life and wise enough to hold them in balance. With equanimity, you can feel the pain of others without being swept away by it, which helps you open to it even more fully. In this book so far, we've explored many ways to develop equanimity in general. To bring equanimity alongside compassion, it helps to stay grounded in your body, aware of the sensations of breathing as you feel the pain of other people. Reflect on the fact that their suffering is part of a vast web of causes and effects. Not to justify or diminish it, but to see the bigger picture with acceptance and insight. Notice what it is like to be deeply touched by another person while at the same time having an inner stability of calm awareness. Let this way of being establish itself in you so you can draw upon it in the future. As you face the enormity of the suffering in this world, you might feel flooded with a sense of despair at the impossibility of ever doing enough. If this happens, it can help to take some kind of action, since action eases despair. There's a story about two people walking down miles of ocean beach on which thousands of starfish had been washed up by the tide and were now dying in the sun. One of them reached down every few steps to toss the starfish back into the water. After a while, the other one said, "There are so many, what you're doing doesn't make any difference." The first person replied, "It makes a world of difference to the ones I pick up." Think about the people in your life, including those you don't know well. Could you make a difference to someone? Seemingly little things can be very touching. Consider humanity in general, as well as non-human animals, and see if something is calling to you. Not to burden you, but to push back against helplessness and despair, and to know you have returned another starfish to the sea. Also take some time to reflect on what you have already done to help others, and on what you are currently doing. Imagine how all this has rippled out into the world in ways seen and unseen. The truth of what you have given rests alongside the truth that there is still much suffering, and knowing the one will help your heart stay open to the other. Forgiving others and yourself. Let's say someone truly mistreated you or made a serious mistake or did this to others. After you deal with the consequences and assert yourself as you judge best, then what? If it seems right, you could draw upon the generosity of forgiveness. Full pardon forgiveness. I think there are two kinds of forgiveness. In the first of these, you give someone a full pardon. It's a complete pass for whatever happened, and you wipe the slate clean. You don't seek compensation, punishment, or repayment of debts. You could continue to believe that what happened was unjust, morally wrong, or a crime, while also having good wishes even love toward the other person. The wheels of justice may still need to turn in their impersonal way, but in your heart you carry no grudge or grievance. You have some understanding of the forces that led people to do what they did. You feel compassion for them, perhaps with the sense that their actions were driven by their suffering. You value their good qualities as human beings and are willing to give relationships a fresh start. While any kind of forgiveness is given unilaterally as a personal choice, it's affected by what others do. It's easier to give a full pardon to people who have admitted what they did, shown remorse, made amends, and taken steps to prevent anything similar in the future. Nonetheless, even if others have taken these steps, and especially if they haven't, a full pardon may just not feel right to you. You may believe that no amount of contrition can ever wipe the slate fully clean. Or you could feel that a full pardon might be possible someday, but you're not yet ready for it. Perhaps you're still in shock. The wound is too fresh. The grieving is too intense. Maybe you want to take some time to be sure that you're not being manipulated by someone who wrongs you, begs forgiveness, and then does it again. Or to be sure that you're not moving to a full pardon due to others who tell you that what happened wasn't so bad and push you to get over it. Sometimes, for whatever reason, a full pardon is out of the question. But you still don't want to be preoccupied by what happened, ruminating about it with hurt and anger. Disentangled forgiveness. This is where disentangled forgiveness is very useful. There is no presumption of a moral pass, compassion, or return to full relationship. It's a much lower bar. The person you are forgiving in this way may in fact keep denying that anything bad happened or even blame you for it. Nonetheless, you are disentangling yourself, finding some closure and release related to the issue, and moving on emotionally. You're trying to help yourself deal with things from the responsive mode, the green zone, no matter what the other person does. With this kind of forgiveness, you may still pursue compensation or punishment as a matter of justice, yet you would do so with no sense of malice or vengeance. You might have to deal with the consequences of what the other person did as a kind of first dart, but you don't add second darts of recrimination, resentment, or revving up your family and friends. If you limit, shrink, or end your relationships with certain people, you do it to protect yourself, not to hurt those who have hurt you. When you remember what happened, it may still sting, but your attention doesn't keep returning to it like a tongue to a cold sore. You are no longer carrying it around. People often start with disentangled forgiveness and eventually move to a full pardon, but there's no assumption that this will occur. Still, if forgiveness is like a house with two floors, knowing that you're not obligated to climb up to the second one, a full pardon, makes it easier to enter the house at all. Foundations for forgiveness. Both kinds of forgiveness are supported by three underlying conditions. First, the time needs to be ripe. Forgiveness is a process akin to Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of grief. First, denial. I can't believe that happened. Second, anger. How dare you treat me that way? Third, bargaining. Look, just admit you made a mistake and we'll be fine. Four, depression. I feel sad and hurt and frustrated. Fifth, acceptance. What happened was bad, but it is what it is, and I want to move on. The last stage is the transition into active forgiveness. As you enter it, use the heal steps to help this acceptance become established in you. Second, truth needs to be told. You can't forgive something fully if you haven't named it fully. The facts of what happened, how it impacted you and others, and how it felt way down deep inside. Know your relevant values and ask yourself, what do I think was wrong here and why? In your mind, establish what you believe without minimizing it or exaggerating it. Have compassion for how all this landed on you. In other words, tell the truth to yourself. Additionally, if you want, tell some or all of it to others. When you've been wronged, the sense of having others stand with you, of having allies who are bearing witness even if there's nothing else they can do, is calming and healing. As you feel their understanding and caring, open to it and receive it into yourself, taking it in like a soothing balm. Then, if it seems safe enough, you could try to talk with the person you want to forgive, and the methods in chapters 9 and 10 will be helpful. After you say what happened and how it affected you, the other person might take a breath and genuinely apologize. But if you are met with a lot of resistance, such as excuses or counter-accusations about you, ask yourself, what do I want to say for my own sake here? This approach is not about persuading or changing the other person, which is out of your control. It's about going on record, feeling free and unafraid, and standing up for yourself, all of which can help you move on to forgiveness. Third, recognize the costs of not forgiving the other person. It pains me to admit the price I've paid for resentment and bitterness in my own life, and to admit how these attitudes have also harmed other people. Feeling put upon and aggrieved can become a too familiar theme in a person's relationships. Disentangling yourself. On these foundations, when you feel ready, you can move into disentangled forgiveness. Here are some good ways to do this. Choose to forgive. Clearly decide that you are going to forgive. Try to stay focused on the benefits to you and others of doing this. Be mindful of the hidden rewards, what therapists call secondary gains, that can keep a person tangled up with grievances, such as the pleasures of righteous anger. Consider their perspective. Without minimizing what the other people did, try to see events through their eyes. What led to their actions? Perhaps their values and standards are different from yours. Maybe what to you was a major violation was to them not a misdeed at all. You can continue to believe in your personal values while also recognizing that others can be acting in good faith in their own minds. Additionally, they may have been hungry, tired, ill, upset, or stressed. Maybe they recently received terrible news. Maybe they just didn't know better. Considering these possibilities doesn't excuse bad behavior, but seeks to understand it more fully in order to feel more peaceful about it. Take responsibility for your experience. Others are responsible for what they do, but we are the source of our reactions to it. If the same mistreatment or injustice landed on 10 people from around the world, there would be differences in how they experienced it. This doesn't mean that someone's reactions are inappropriate, but that they're shaped by that person's own mind. Recognizing this doesn't invalidate your experience, but holds it more lightly, which helps untangle you from it. Know what you're going to do. Depending on what happened, you could decide to write a letter, skip a family gathering, call a lawyer, stop confiding in someone, use a different plumber, or simply watch and wait. Other people will do whatever they do, and meanwhile, focus on your own actions. Knowing what your plan is, and that you have a plan and are not helpless, is calming and centering, and this makes more room in your mind for forgiveness. Let go of any ill will. With disentangled forgiveness, you may not like the people who wronged you, and you may be taking action against them. But you are letting go of any hostility or vindictiveness. To do this, be aware of what resentment feels like in your body, and then use long exhalations to relax and to release these sensations. Visualize ill will as a heavy stone that you are setting down. You might like to pick up a real stone. Imagine that it contains all of your desires for vengeance, and then drop it or throw it far, far away. You could write a letter that you'll never send, perhaps full of bitterness, scorn, and punishing rage, and then cut it into small pieces, burn it, and cast the ashes to the wind. Use the link step in Heal to bring antidote experiences into ill will to ease and gradually replace it. For instance, be aware of resentment off to the side of your mind while a sense of others who care about you is large and powerful. As you rest increasingly in disentangled forgiveness, know what it feels like. Enrich this experience by staying with it, letting it fill your mind, sensing it in your body, exploring what feels new or fresh about it, and recognizing how it is relevant and important to you. Absorb it by sensing that forgiveness is sinking into you and by focusing on what feels good about it. Take a breath and step out of the tangles. Giving a full pardon. Years ago, when our kids were little, a neighbor's tall tree fell into our backyard and knocked down the fence between us. We asked him to take care of the tree and he agreed, but weeks and then months passed with no action. I'd talk with him and he'd smile and promise to deal with it, but nothing happened. It was getting ridiculous and I was getting mad. But that wasn't helping my family or me, and I started moving into disentangled forgiveness. I thought, it was just a tree, not our house burning down, and I didn't need to add my own anger to the simple facts of the situation. This forgiveness was aided by knowing what I was going to do, which included writing the neighbor a polite but firm letter saying that our insurance company would be contacting him. The day after he received the letter, about 5 months after the tree fell, there was a crew in our backyard to remove it. But it was still very awkward between us, and I wanted to find my way to a full pardon. So I thought about him as a person, not as a two-dimensional jerk of a neighbor. He was an older man living alone in a broken-down house surrounded by dry grass and weeds, and no one ever visited him. I remembered that he was fond of the raccoons that came into his yard, and he set out food for them. On Halloween, when our kids came to his door, he showered them with candy. I could see that he had a good heart and was probably worried about money and the cost of removing the tree, plus dealing with loneliness and aging. I felt compassion for him, with some understanding of the many factors that kept the tree in our backyard. I recalled his halting attempt at an apology and winced at the memory of brushing it aside. I imagined what a tiny speck that tree would be when seen from outer space. I felt the moral weight of this teaching from the Buddha. Quote, "There are those who do not realize that one day we all must die, but those who do realize this settle their quarrels." Unquote. Through these steps, I came to a full pardon, and we lived beside each other with a neighborly friendliness. When he did die a few years later, I felt sad about it and glad that I'd come to peace with him. When I look back at my neighbor in the tree, there are some good lessons in it. See the whole person. When we're appalled, hurt, or angry, it's easy to reduce people to the one terrible thing they did. But around that is so much else. Other intentions that were good, a whole complex life history, and their own hopes and dreams. When we see the whole, it's not as hard to forgive the part. Everyone suffers, including the people who wrong us. Whatever they did is not negated or excused by their pain and loss and stress, but compassion for the load they carry makes it easier to forgive the load they put on you. As Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote, quote, "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm any hostility." Unquote. Sometimes people will give you a direct and sincere apology. In other cases, they won't admit any fault, but you can see a change of heart in their actions. Try to see their efforts, even if implicit or imperfect, to reach out, mend what's been torn, and ask you for forgiveness. Take a wide view. Place whatever happened in the context of your whole life, including your many relationships and activities. Think about the many minutes and years and the many parts of your life that will be untouched and unharmed by what occurred. Take an even wider view and try to see what happened as a swirling collection of events swept along by many factors, like an eddy in a vast river of causes. This perspective may seem abstract at first, but it will become a felt recognition of the truth of what you are forgiving many parts, many causes, continually changing. Seeing and feeling this draws you naturally into letting go, which aids full pardon forgiveness. Forgiving yourself. Many people find